Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In 2005, Jeffrey Sachs offered a prescription for ending poverty in the world by 2025. His best-selling book, The End of Poverty, asked why the fight against hunger and hopelessness is not fought with the same commitment as a war is waged. Now in a new book, he warns that unless the world's population is not stabilized, the environment protected, poverty addressed, and prosperity shared, the world's economic system may collapse. His new book is titled Common Wealth, and Jeffrey Sachs joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
What a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. You write that during this century, American global dominance will come to an end. Why do you believe that is so?
Not for bad news, not because we're going to collapse, but because other parts of the world are catching up with the United States in technological capacity, in improving living standards. So I call this an age of convergence, meaning a narrowing of the gap, at least potentially, between the rich and the poor. Not by the rich getting poorer, but by the poor getting richer. A good thing, potentially, if we can manage this properly.
Now, are you saying other countries are moving more quickly than the U.S. is to close that gap?
We see the greatest economic boom in history taking place in Asia right now. China, of course, with all of the controversies and debates and issues, is achieving a rate of economic growth for a size of population, 1.3 billion people, that has simply never before been seen on the planet. China has been doubling the size of its economy every 7 years. This is phenomenally good news in important ways. It means a vast improvement of life standards, of longevity, of reduced disease and child mortality, reduced hunger, for huge numbers of people. The same thing is now starting to happen in India, another vast country with a billion people, and in other parts of Asia. What's happening there, in essence, is that the technologies that give us our high productivity and high living standards are becoming part of their lives as well. And on the whole, technology is something that can be shared worldwide without a costing one side at the expense of another.
What about Africa?
Africa, of course, has been the center of my own focus for many years because Africa, and by that we mean part of Africa below the Sahara Desert, sub-Saharan Africa, has been trapped in extreme poverty while so much of the rest of the world's been moving forward. And I've been arguing that that poverty trap needs to be broken so that Africa, too, can experience the kind of progress that China and India are experiencing. And it has to be said that for every country that now is getting out of poverty, it once was said that it would be impossible for them to do so. India was considered a basket case, but India made its breakthrough, and I believe Africa can do the same thing. What I'm worried about, of course, is that the tragedy in Africa, where millions of children die every year of poverty for conditions that could so easily be controlled, where societies are unstable because people are hungry, where water crises lead to the explosions of violence in places like Darfur, that if we just leave this as it is and say, well, that's their problem, tough luck, we have our own problems, those problems come back to hurt us in so many ways. The international spread of disease, the risks of terror, the way we end up getting involved in war or in violence or mass movements of population, not to anybody's favor, because it's desperate movements of people moving across national boundaries and often causing a lot of disruption. They become victims of the disruption that is caused.
How has India managed to raise itself, and are there lessons there to apply to Africa?
Wonderful question, and I think there are wonderful lessons. India's modern breakthrough into high economic growth from a low starting point, from a lot of poverty, but real improvement now, really dates back to the 1960s. India was, as had been so often the case, in a famine after a drought in the mid-1960s, and there was widespread hunger and widespread worry. We were in the Cold War. People thought that India would become destabilized and so forth. And that was the moment of change when it was realized through wonderful scientific leaders, most notably a wonderful, remarkable gentleman named Norman Borlaug, a great plant scientist, that India could double or even triple its food production by using better seed varieties. And this became known as the Indian Green Revolution, the idea that by planting a better kind of seed for wheat and for rice, and then with the help for these impoverished farmers to have irrigation on their farms and to get the fertilizer to plant together with the seeds, that what was a desperate case of hunger could be alleviated quickly. And remarkably, what happened from the 1960s onward is the United States government worked together with India, worked together with the Rockefeller Foundation, which was promoting the science. There was a partnership. Made sense. The U.S. actually shipped a lot of fertilizer to India in the late 1960s. The Rockefeller Foundation helped to finance a lot of these new seed varieties that Norman Borlaug had developed. And within a few years, what had seemed like hopeless hunger became a food surplus. And then it didn't stop there, because good economics doesn't stop there. What is possible is to climb the ladder of development. And once there was a foothold on that ladder in India, the farmers themselves went from growing only a grain to taking cows and making a dairy industry, and then to higher value cash crops, then to non-agricultural activities in the rural areas of Punjab and other parts of India that were experiencing this green revolution. And then through the education, improved skills, and the wonders of modern technology, the information revolution, India not only could feed itself, but became leader of so much of the information technology revolution. So one thing leads to another. And my point is that one thing leads to another is a common phenomenon. It could be one bad thing leads to one worse thing if we're not careful, or one good thing turns into one yet better thing.
Jeffrey Sachs, he's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, special advisor to former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. His new book is titled Common Wealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. We will certainly take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You talk about the four risks that the world faces, and at the top of that list, you put human pressures on the Earth's ecosystem and climate. This notion that the world's population is growing at a faster rate than the Earth itself can sustain.
Not only do we have a lot of people on the planet now, 6.7 billion people, but on average, they are about 10 to 15 times more productive and using more resources than was true at the start of our modern industrial age. And so the population's gone up about 10 times, and the use of resources at least 10 times, we're more than 100 times bearing a stress on the Earth's environment. It's unprecedented what's happening. This goes to the climate change. It goes to the fisheries that are being depleted in the oceans. It goes to the tropical forests that are being cleared. It goes to the endangered species that are losing their habitat or being hunted to extinction. And it is, in my view, not malevolence. It's not even greed. It's just absent-mindedness in a way, because this has come upon us so fast as a human society. We tend to think of our lives in our families and our communities, maybe our countries, of course. But now we're a world species, all interconnected, taking so much of the Earth's resources as never before. And really, we're not yet appreciating the implications of that. But if you look in the newspaper, any day these days, coal prices at all-time high, oil prices at all-time high, fisheries being extinct. Don't eat this at the restaurant. Don't eat that at the restaurant. New risks of pollutants because of the mass chemical spills. So many of China's cities now major water-stressed regions because the waters have been polluted or so much water has been used for irrigation or for industrial purposes. My book is not pessimistic or alarmist, though. I want to be clear about that. It is saying, can't we talk about some serious things? And I thank you so much for making the opportunity. That's why your show is remarkable. Can't we talk about serious things in our country and in the world? Because we need to. We need to understand that it's not hopeless. It's not false alarmism. It's a need to confront the future that we're building and to make the right choices so that the future is secure.
Jeffrey Sachs. His new book is titled Common Wealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. The phones are open. Short break. We'll be right back. And if you've just joined us, Jeffrey Sachs is with me. He has a brand new book out titled Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. And here's the first email from Bill in Dallas, Texas, who says, I don't believe the Earth can handle the impact of the more than 6 billion people on it now. It's obvious every physical and natural resource is near exhaustion. Soon we will have oceans devoid of fish, forests devoid of trees, and soil devoid of nutrients. The very sad conclusion, given that humans lack the collective will to reduce their numbers by having smaller families, is that nature will have to reduce the numbers for us. The arsenal of tools at its disposal will lead to a horrific epoch in human history. Pretty pessimistic, Jeff Sachs.
Well, the book is written because those are real risks, but I think they are avoidable. We have to decide to avoid them. We have to talk about these things. Understand each of the challenges that Bill has discussed, oceans, energy, forests, soils, and population. And if we do talk about them, I believe there is a brighter future.
How do we talk about population without talking about politics?
Well, we have to talk about politics for sure, because these are decisions that societies make. And let me say a word about population. Most of the world has reduced fertility rates now pretty significantly, so that they're close to a level where the population in the world could stabilize. But the poorest places have not. That's the irony, that it's the places that can least afford the population increases, that have the least prospect of creating good gainful employment, that have the least ability to raise healthy children with proper nutrition, where the fertility rates remain highest, places in Central Asia or in parts of Africa and in other very poor regions. That paradox is a typical finding, that when places do get wealthier, there's more family planning, there's more access to health services, there's more access to contraception. Women's time is worth more. Women are more empowered, and they choose to have fewer numbers of children. What I argue in the book is that we've learned so much about how this voluntary fertility reduction has occurred in so many places that we can actively help those places still with massive rates of population growth to get their populations under control for their own benefit and for the world's stability.
Give me an example of where the U.S. has acted positively in that direction.
Well, it's fascinating that in the 1960s and 1970s, the U.S. actually led the effort to expand family planning. We used to talk about things like contraceptive availability and family planning, and we said that this is a choice for people. With President Reagan in the 1980s, it became politics, and it became a political football where constituency here said, we don't even want to hear the words condom or contraception or those things. We pretended this wasn't a problem. The Bush administration, this one, similarly cut off all funding for the United Nations Population Fund. They say they're protecting our security, but we know from extensive evidence, common sense, lots of data, that it's places with the population bulging of unemployed young men that are the most dangerous in terms of spilling over into violence. So we don't even have a coherent approach in terms of national security to this. If we did, we would be continuing a long national tradition in this country, broken by President Bush, unfortunately, and by President Reagan. We would continue a national tradition to help other countries achieve a voluntary reduction of fertility. We would support things like the United Nations Population Fund.
Here's an email from Andrew, who says, like many, your guest talks about a new economy. So why does he use the same old metrics, GDP, to measure progress? Wealth brings little to many when that wealth is in very few hands. Perhaps your guest could talk about the distribution of wealth in India.
In fact, increases in GDP, as he said, the gross domestic product, or GNP, the gross national product, in these poor countries is reflecting a pretty broad-based improvement of living conditions. If you look in India or in China or in other places nearby those countries, I was just in Korea last week, I was recently in Malaysia, those are places that were extremely poor. People were hungry. Children died 20, 30, 40 years ago. And the progress is palpable. It's obvious. It's important for us to understand it, by the way, because those are going to be new economic powers. And I'm not sure we have fully in mind how successful those places have been. When we think of ourselves as the indispensable superpower that can push everyone else around, that was a myth. Going into Iraq, for example, because we don't understand that other places have caught up in many ways and have narrowed the gap. So I don't think that it's purely a numbers game. I don't think that the progress is an illusion. But I do think that there are adverse side effects to our economic activity in the way we increase the greenhouse gases or put pressures on the way we fish and the way we farm that could have disastrous boomerang effects on the whole world if we're continuing to pretend that those side effects don't exist.
Andrew asked about the wealth distribution in India. Do you see that happening?
Well, of course, there are some incredibly rich Indians who have become rich as part of this boom, as part of the IT revolution of India. I'm more worried, frankly, about what's happened to the wealth distribution in the United States, which has widened to an unbelievable, unconscionable level before our eyes, and not just by market forces, but by deliberate politics in this country of tax cuts for the super rich, of deregulation, which has allowed the super rich to make their profits in the short term, take away unbelievable bonuses and compensation, and then watch whole banks like Bear Stearns disappear before our eyes. So there is an income distribution problem, and it's here, and we should focus on that.
I want to ask you about water, because many people have called water the gold of the 21st century. And the distribution, the rights, not only here in the United States, but all over the world, how much of a problem is that going to be in your research, and what would it take to fix it?
Water's a very big deal, and it's a pretty tough issue because it's not as easy with water as it is with other things like energy resources or substituting fish farms for ocean fishing to make up for water scarcity. If you look at where the violence in the world is right now, in the worst cases, places like Darfur, Sudan, like Somalia, like the Middle East, like Pakistan, Afghanistan, these are all water-stressed regions. We call them Islamic fundamentalist regions. We should call them water-stressed regions. We should understand that these are places that are hungry, where livelihoods have been put in grave danger, where old traditional ways of living, such as pastoralist communities, are under life and death threat. And we then blame religion, or we blame militarism, or we blame terrorism without understanding those are symptoms of a much deeper challenge, and water is at the center of it. And it's going to get worse with water because climate change is going to shift who gets the rainfall, because climate change is going to make the dry places even drier. Because places now that are living not on the river water or the rain, but on the groundwater, are pumping the water from underground faster than it's being replenished in India or in China. Because places like the Andean countries that live off of the melting glaciers can live as long as there are glaciers, but once they disappear because of global warming in the next 30 or 40 years, whole regions that have water supplies now are going to find they don't have water supplies. So I regard this one as actually the toughest of all of them.
Because how do you fix it?
And like everything I say in the book, there's no magic bullet for any of these answers. There typically are powerful technologies that can be applied in some of the places for some of the needs. In water, of course, if you're on the coast and you have the means, desalination can provide some answer. If you're using water in an inefficient way, wonderful technologies like drip irrigation rather than the more traditional irrigation can save the water that you're using. So there are tricks of the trade which are very powerful, and we have to think scientifically and technologically. But it's also going to be the case that there are large regions of the world that are going to be water-stressed and too poor on their own to face the problem. And we're already, in my opinion, seeing the resulting violence that can come from it. We send the army in response. We solve nothing. We spend tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. We need to send engineers, not the army. And it's until we understand that the fundamental problems need to be addressed, not the symptoms, we're going to continue to get it wrong, waste lives, waste our money and not find solutions.
In talking about the cost to fix the kinds of problems that you deal with in the book, you say a group of global public investments undertaken by the nations of the world is needed in order to avert the greatest risks facing the world. How many nations do you believe would be willing to cooperate in such an effort?
Let me give you the surprising answer, but it's based on a lot of experience. All of them. The whole idea that we're in this war to the end with places like Iran completely misunderstands the reality that we're in. Because Iran, what are they really thinking about? Their water scarcity, their energy future, what's going to happen to their people, their food security. If we could get it into our heads a little more effectively that rather than fighting and threatening only as if we have one note in our band, that we could actually say, why don't we work together to solve some of these problems? Climate, water, food security, soils, things that are the real life and death issue of people all over the world, we'd find a phenomenal response. How do I know that? Because as an advisor to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon now, as I was to Secretary General Kofi Annan in the recent past, I have a chance to speak to world leaders everywhere across every religious divide, cultural divide, class divide, and so forth. Everybody's worried about these deeper issues. Everybody is looking for solutions. Everybody understands that we need better technology, better science. Everybody is ready for their own futures, their own narrow interests, as well as the global interest to work together. But what are we doing? We're viewing it as an us versus them rather than an all of us versus a crisis. And until we get over the us versus them, we're not going to solve it.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Marlene in near Chicago, Illinois. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's Maureen. I've just finished End of Poverty, Jeffrey Sachs' book, and my book group will actually be discussing it tonight. And one of the questions that arises in my client, actually, it's a three-prong one. First, when we when economic development occurs, as you propose, does not also some of the things that have happened in this country come with it, namely the danger to the environment, rampant consumerism, changes in values that some countries would rather perhaps not have? And is there a way to do this so that doesn't occur, and most especially the importation of Western culture in terms of music and movies and things like that? And the second one deals with your comment in that book that as much as the differential diagnosis is needed, sometimes corrupt or inefficient governments trump economic development. And you just talked about Somalia and the water problem, and Somalia is a country where there is no central government. So I'd appreciate comments on those.
Thank you, Marlene.
What a great show. You get to talk to people that are going to have a book club about your book the same day. So thank you, Maureen. First, I have to say there are no perfect solutions in our world. So all good things tend to come with side effects. Nobody's figured out how to make the utopia. As there's economic development, yes, there is consumerism. Yes, there are environmental threats of a new kind, though poor people also create environmental threats because they have to stay alive by cutting down trees or overfishing and so forth. Yes, corrupt governments can do great damage, and the outside world may not be able to help those places. Regime change from the outside doesn't work, so we may not have answers. So I want to stress, first of all, there aren't answers for everything. I believe that on the whole, though, we can make a lot of progress. What I have emphasized and experienced is that throughout Africa, there are many, many governments that are ready to take up the challenge. Honest elected governments. Well, honest like any government is. There's always some corruption, always some threat, but not kind of rampant destroy a country kind of corruption like you have in Zimbabwe, but normal, low levels, controllable kinds of corruption. And I say if we're smart in how we work together with those countries, we also design the kind of help that is less likely to be stolen. For example, I'm very keen on controlling malaria, as you would know from reading the book. And I say instead of giving money so that countries can buy bed nets to fight malaria, let's ship bed nets. They're harder to steal. They don't fit in safe deposit boxes. You can track them. You can have the Red Cross and others distribute them. So let's just think about clever ways to do these things. But I can't pretend that I have a solution to all of the problems, only to help the poorest of the poor get out of the life and death struggle that they're in, because children are dying massively, and this is to nobody's benefit.
Jeffrey Sachs, his new book is titled Common Wealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet. After a short break, we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate, Should Religion and Politics Mix? Video, transcript, and broadcast details at millercenter.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, treating patients who can't talk, but they sure can bark and meow, we talk with animal surgeon Nick Trout, author of the new memoir, Tell Me Where It Hurts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We'll go right back to the phones. Your questions, comments for Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. His new book is titled Common Wealth. Let's go to Northfield, Ohio. Good morning, Cindy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'd like to know what your opinion is on, as far as population control and using up the Earth's resources, these people that are literally kept alive with no quality of life, including my own 88-year-old mother, who goes from the wheelchair to the bed, and that's it.
Well, Cindy,
you go into any nursing home, and they're just sitting at the end of the hall. I mean, it's pathetic, and I'm not saying kill them, but why are we keeping these people alive?
Cindy, of course, the question of quality of life and individual choice and individuals' beliefs, religious and moral and all the rest, come into this. From my point of view as an economist, let me stress that it's not the burden of the elderly which will do in the planet, so we shouldn't think about the burden of aging as a fundamental threat. I have a few pages on this in the book where the claim that's made that because of the aging, we're all going to go bankrupt is not right. Of course, this isn't meant to address the complicated questions that come up with modern medicine and with choice and quality of life. But as an economist, focusing on the challenge of the burden of human activity, that means economic production, on our planet and what to do about it, that's not a major issue, thank goodness. We don't have to make a choice between the young and the old and staying alive. What we should do, though, is to help today's young not have so many children in the poor places where still women are having 5 or 6 or 7 or even 8 children. That's not good for them. That is also not sustainable at a global scale.
Here is an email from Leslie in Southlake, Texas, who thanks you for your work and leadership. She'd like to know, what actions can she take as an average American citizen to help create a world of commonwealth? And secondly, which of the presidential candidates do you believe can best help us as individuals do this?
Well, thank you so much. The last chapter of Commonwealth is called The Power of One, because I believe we all have power to help change things, and we all need to exercise it. This is not something that's going to be solved by a president of the United States. I should say, not this one also, because we've gone in the wrong direction in the current administration. But it's going to come only if the American people say, let's get our eyes open to the real challenges, not to the fear-mongering and to the war, but actually to the investments in our future. And what you can do, I think, is first learn about the issues. It's extremely important. Bring your friends into an active discussion about the challenges of global poverty, climate change, environmental distress. These are real problems. They're really important. They have some fascinating, positive solutions, but we all need to learn about them. And then I say that every business, every community group, a church group, and so forth can take on an effort, help send bed nets to a poor community to save children dying of malaria. Of course, get politically involved to choose which candidate is really talking about these things in a sensible way. Now, I have to say, as a senior UN official, I don't take sides in our presidential campaign, but let me just give a few points. The key for me is, can we address these issues in a globally cooperative way? Can we see that the need is peace through sustainable development, not peace through militarized approaches, which will not work? We can send troops everywhere. We're spending $700 billion this year, $700 billion on the Pentagon. We will spend trillions of dollars. It counts for this Iraq war without results that are going to secure our future. We need to address the more fundamental issues of extreme poverty, of global population, of climate change, of a sustainable energy system, of managing water resources, of protecting the habitat of other species. If our children are going to live in a safe and secure world, and this is not an us versus them challenge, this is all the whole world faces the same challenges right now. And the fascinating thing is that not only addressing these challenges would help us solve them, but would also help us to understand that we have so much more that unites us in this world than all the things that we claim divide us. That's what I would ask. What are the candidates saying about that?
Let's go now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Jack.
Yeah, I had a question about economic development, but I just want to make a comment about overpopulation. I wanted to urge all your younger listeners who put a great deal of faith in expert predictions and computer models to read The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich and The Club of Rome, which was written in the early 80s. I'll get a kind of a good laugh out of both of those. But my question about economic development in regards to India and China, you mentioned technology and you mentioned education, but you had no mention of free market reforms or taxation policy. And it's my understanding Daniels had a major impact in both those countries. In the past 50 years, we've seen it, a laboratory, a side-by-side laboratory of the two methods, East-West Germany, North and South Korea, Hong Kong versus mainland China. And even in America, we've seen a population migration to low-income tax states because that's where the jobs are. So my question is, what role does this play? And I want to make the point that the alternative to a free market approach is, in our contemporary times, is where you have people making decisions, government or whoever, who don't have skin in the game. You end up something with an industry like the ethanol industry, who even the Greens call a boondoggle.
All right, Jack, thanks for calling.
Jack, thanks a lot. I'd love for you to read my book and give me some comments, because I make the point that, of course, markets are very powerful and efficient. You're absolutely right that market reforms in China and in India have played a very important role. But I also say that markets aren't everything, and that we need a mixed economy. Government has a lot of responsibility in core investments in infrastructure, in making sure that there is social security. I believe we do better if our government had a clear role in health as well, because we leave, unlike all the rest of the rich world, we leave, as you know, 50 million people without health insurance right now. That, to my mind, makes no sense for a $15 trillion economy such as ours. So I think it's very important to emphasize, as you do, the gains from markets, but it's also important to keep in mind their limits. Markets don't solve the problems of climate change by themselves. They don't solve the problems of environmental degradation. They don't protect the poor by themselves. They don't provide social security by themselves. They don't provide a lot of the infrastructure. And so we need a mixed economy that gives full strength to markets, but we have to also realize that when the government gets involved, that doesn't mean that it's killing the market system. It means that it's making it stronger and complementing the market system.
Richard from Norman, Oklahoma, asks whether there is a political agenda behind your research and recommendations.
Well, in a way, yes, but not a hidden one. It's not a partisan political agenda. I don't work in Washington, although I'm working in Washington today, happy to be here for the day, but I'm not looking for a government job and not promoting a particular party. It's politics in another sense. It's politics in what we need to do together. It's the idea that we need to take some actions together, and I don't mean just within our country. I mean worldwide, to face the climate change problem, to face the overfishing problem, to face the destruction of other species, to help stabilize the world's population, to address the urgent challenge of 10 million children who will die this year because they're too poor to stay alive, something we can't even imagine for one of our children. And I just said 10 million children. So this is politics in a different sense, that we together, our generation, has this phenomenal opportunity to address the sustainable development of our planet. It's our greatest challenge, and I think if we work together, we can do it. Working together means private sector, means churches, it means technology and scientists, and we'll let the politicians come into this also.
Here's an email from Daniel in Provo, Utah, who says, I come from a family of 9 children. I get worried about the rhetoric of some that families should have fewer children. I consider being able to have as many children as one pleases to be a basic human right. The problem being described can be resolved using other means, such as more development in green industries, micro-lending, etc.
Well, Daniel, as one of 9 children, I can understand your sentiment. And I also believe that this is a right, but not necessarily a choice that people should be making to have such large families. Suppose that everybody had 9 children. We would have a population that is probably roughly tripling every 20 to 25 years. And the world couldn't bear it. The water, the ecosystems, the life support systems, the energy, we couldn't do it, actually. So it's not a generalizable situation. It's one that I can understand from your perspective as a member of what I'm sure is a happy and large family, but it's not something that the world can do.
Here's William in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, asking about the church. Good morning, William.
Yes. Mr. Sachs, I have noticed that the what they call the MDGs, I believe.
Right.
Gets a lot of play in different churches or what have you. And but I seem to have the idea that they just kind of play around the edges. It's kind of almost like, I think, the butterfly effect. Do they really understand that their very consumptive lifestyle really has a butterfly effect all the way down the line?
William, let me say for all the listeners what the MDGs are. Those are the Millennium Development Goals, which the whole world agreed to help fight extreme poverty, extreme hunger, and this terrible burden of disease like malaria that I keep referring to. And we set some goals for the year 2015, and then our government seemed to forget about them. But I'm delighted to hear that the churches in your area are remembering them. These are global commitments to help the poorest of the poor. And the main thing I want to stress is we should not try to solve the environment problem by holding back the poorest of the poor. People are dying because they don't have enough to stay alive. We need to help those people. And then we need to bring the technologies and lifestyles to make it possible for the whole world to enjoy prosperity.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's see. Here's an email from one of our listeners, Gregory, who says that President Bush just visited Africa and has directed much aid toward fighting disease and poverty there. Why has your guest not addressed this issue fairly today?
Gregory, great question. The president has made one major initiative called PEPFAR, which is the emergency program to fight AIDS. And at a smaller scale, but also important, a new initiative to help fight malaria. And when the president toured Africa, you could see the thrills in Africa for this help that's been given. And I have called them in the past our weapons of mass salvation, that if we can help get bed nets and medicines to Africans, this is the greatest security that we could give, as well as the life-saving means for these people. The reason that I don't go overboard in the praise is that that's all that the administration's done in this. And in a $15 trillion economy, our total level of help for Africa is about, $5-6 per African right now. That's not enough. And we promise to do a lot more. We're spending, if I could put it in these terms, Gregory, we're spending 3 cents, maybe up to 4 cents out of every $100 of our income to help this poorest of the poor region of the world. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on the military down the drain, down the drain. And this, I think, is the point that we should applaud these successful programs, but not lose sight that as a country, we decided to take the military approach rather than the peaceful development approach. And we've spent about $1 trillion so far in that wrong direction. And we, by being not recognizing the level that we should be helping on development, we've left places in desperate conditions in water or in food, hunger, and at a great threat to ourselves by that kind of neglect.
Do you believe, you've said that all the countries of the world are prepared to move forward collectively in making some contribution to the changes that must be made. But it does seem that population is at the center of this whole issue when you think about the consumption of resources and the ongoing problems with the atmosphere. Do you believe we're ready to move forward?
I've discussed this with a number of African leaders recently who have put population at the center of their development strategy. So, yes, I think we could find a lot of common ground on that, on climate change, on sustainable energy, on protecting the oceans. Let's find the common ground. We're going to find a much safer world if we do so.
And Jeffrey Sachs' new book is titled Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. He is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to former Secretary General Kofi Annan and now the new Secretary General as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be with you, Diane.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.